Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure. We're here today with Michael Wolff, a renowned viticulturalist and a staple in Napa Valley for a number of decades, highly regarded, and it's quite an honor to have a conversation with you, Michael. I cannot wait to delve into past, present, and hopefully talk a little bit about the future. I want to start with your background. I understand you're from the East Coast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I grew up just outside of New York City on Long Island, and went to school in upstate New York, graduated with a bachelor's in history.
Liberal arts.
And once that was done, it struck me that I had learned to read and write, but I didn't have anything that I could do anything with unless I wanted to go to school some more. And I didn't want to go to school anymore. I was just kind of desperate to feel like I could do something.
Yes.
So I went to night school and learned how to weld.
Weld?
Yeah.
Why welding?
Yeah. It was almost by default, I knew there was work.
Oh, practical.
And yeah, it was totally practical. Totally practical. And it turned out in the long run, I had no idea at the time that I was going to get involved with farming. It turned out to be super useful, over time, which was just a kind of a convenient, nice coincidence. Mm-hmm. But a couple of friends and I, guys that I knew from college, had always talked about, buying a piece of land. That was kind of the thing in the early 70s, doing that whole back to the land thing. And mostly it was just bar talk. We would talk about it and dream about it and think about it. And one of them had a friend, an old time friend from when he lived in Washington, D.C., who had moved up to Mendocino County, and she bought this really cool farm, an old apple farm out in the middle of nowhere, halfway between Ukiah and Mendocino.
Wow.
And truly in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And Bill came out to visit Natalie one vacation. I don't know if it was spring or if it was over Thanksgiving. It was probably spring. And came back to school and said, "Yeah, I think I found a place." I'm like, "No, really? We're actually going to do this?" And there was this big tract of land that had been owned by Louisiana Pacific, big lumber company, and they had logged it in probably the late 1950s. And, just a corporate decision decided they were not going to log it again, ever. That either it was growing back too slowly or it was too remote or something, for whatever reason. So they sold it, and this guy bought it and split it up into anything from, I think he actually had some parcels there that were a full section, like 640 acres, and then all the way down to 40s. So we decided to do it. And it was a pretty big leap of faith, but, that being said, in 1972, it was $12,500 for 40 acres.
Oh my goodness.
But 40 acres were all you were getting. I mean, there was nothing there. There was no power. There was no phone. All the development, if you want to call it that, was just remnants of logging. So there were some roads, there were a few flat spots that they had built to load trucks, no developed water, no nothing.
My goodness.
Yeah, so it was kind of a big deal for us to do it, but we were young. I mean, it's a good thing to do when you're in your early 20s.
That must have tested you. You grew up in an urban environment,
mm-hmm.
Correct. And all of a sudden you find yourself right. in logging land.
Right. Exactly.
How was
that? It was pretty cool, actually. It was, the biggest adjustment really was just getting used to the quiet.
There was just nothing
around.
Yes.
And we were just about halfway between Ukiah and Mendocino. So you go 18 miles out this semi-improved county road, and then another 3.5 miles up a dirt road to get there. And when you were there, you were there. And we would never, ever, ever go to town more than one day a week. Because it took all day.
Of course. No, I understand. I've spent some time in Anderson Valley, which is not nearly as remote. Yeah. But for those of you that have been to Mendocino Coast, they know exactly what we're talking about. For those that haven't, it's worth to experience that.
Yeah.
Your mind is so much quieter,
mm-hmm.
and you actually get to be with yourself. You have no other choice.
Right.
It could be helpful.
Right. Yeah, and all we were, there was a great sense of urgency about everything that we did, because we got there in the early spring. We had to wait for things to dry out a little bit to even be able to get up the road.
Yeah, for sure.
We stayed with Bill's friend in the valley below where we were for a week or so, and then we were able to get up there, and then we needed to make a place to live before next winter.
It's like a Survivor edition early.
yeah.
Early on.
Yeah. So it was very focused. We worked incredibly hard. And it was just an amazing experience. Very, very rewarding experience, because the reality set in, like the first day we were there. If you didn't do it, it wasn't going to happen.
Wow, what a life lesson.
Yeah.
How old were you?
I was 22.
Oh, my God.
21, 22.
Wow. That's quite a powerful introduction to reality.
Yeah, it was.
Most 22-year-olds. It was,
but, given the choices, it kind of beat Vietnam.
Indeed.
And did that for a while. When we went, we literally had all of our worldly belongings and all of our money with us, mm-hmm. And we knew we were going to just burn through it, because mm-hmm. there was no way we could do anything on the outside to make money. We needed to build stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
So what a concept.
So we did that, and first winter, I left during the first winter and went and stayed with some friends in Eugene, because mm-hmm. I needed to make money. And I was the only one without they had marketable skills. I had my welding skills. That was where that mm-hmm. happened. One of them was a carpenter, the other a commercial photographer. So they had stuff they could do. Mm-hmm. And so I went up to Eugene, worked in a big steel fabricating place up there. Mm-hmm. And it was good to just get away.
Sure.
And be away from each other. It was a pretty intense thing.
So there was three of you?
Just three single guys.
Got it.
And the dog.
Important,
absolutely. Absolutely. And came back and worked all the next summer on the place, and then needed to make money again. And I decided, in my own wisdom at the time, that I wanted to be a logger. Yeah.
Wow. Yet another very physical expression.
Well, we were all in really good shape. Because all we did was work.
Okay.
But I had
hard work.
But I had no idea what hard work really was.
I was going to say, I don't know
until
either.
I did that.
Theoretically, even.
That was crazy hard work. I was in really good condition from working all the time on the place. And in the first month, I lost 30 pounds.
My goodness.
Eating like a horse. It was really, really hard. But I decided the reason that I did it was because there were other people our age, kind of in the broader neighborhood, you know, mm-hmm. of Mendocino County, who just absolutely hated loggers on their face.
Yeah. Why is that?
Well, because they had destroyed all of the beautiful old countryside and cut down all of the redwood trees, did all of that, and I didn't think it could possibly be that simple.
Yeah.
So I figured the only way to really understand what it was about was to do it for a while.
Yeah, wow. So there's some part of you that really wanted to get to the bottom of why things are what they are.
Yeah, I wanted to understand why the land was the way it was.
Okay.
You know, because we were very, very tied to that land. It was everything to us. And it was important, you know, and there was no other way to do it. You know, just sitting there talking about what bad people the loggers were wasn't going to get anywhere.
Were you intimidating? You know, were you intimidated by the prospect of, you know, this is a very isolated, probably insular area, and what was your state of mind like at the time? You just wanted to try it and go do it, or?
Yeah. I wanted to try it and go do it, and I wanted to find out who all of those people were. You know, it was a whole group of people that I had never had any contact whatsoever with.
You know, yeah.
Where I grew up, everybody was the same.
Sure.
You know, they all lived in suburban New York City.
Yeah.
Where I went to school, everybody was the same.
Yeah. So there was natural curiosity.
It was natural curiosity. It was a need to make money.
Yes.
It was a desire to not take a job in town.
Okay.
It was a desire to continue to be able to be outside all the time.
Yes.
So it kind of checked all of those boxes.
Very cool.
You know, the stupidity and the dangerous part of it wasn't anything I was thinking about.
You were young. You know, none of us think about
that. I was young and indestructible and exactly. All of that stuff. Yeah, so I did that for 5 summers.
Wow.
Yeah. And I thought that after that amount of time I had learned what I was going to learn. And I hadn't gotten really badly hurt, which was just a matter of time. I mean, that just happens to everybody who does that long enough. It's just a very weird, dangerous environment. So I stopped doing it. But what I learned, truly, and it was another one of those life lessons, was that the guys in the logging industry were just like everybody else. There were good ones and there were bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's true in it. Every profession, every trade, and you know, and what I'm doing now, there are people who are really good farmers, and there are people that are really bad at it, and they do it anyhow, and they all get lumped into one bucket. You know, they're all farmers.
That is such an important point.
You know, and it was the same with the loggers. Yeah. I mean, they're all bad guys. Well, not really. Some of them were, but some of them were really good guys.
I think whenever we know very little about the subject matter, we tend to assume, like you said, lump everything together. So if you don't know much about viticulture, anybody that practices it becomes somebody that, you know, you're impressed by.
Right.
But you just made such a great point that that's not how it is at all.
Mm-mm.
So have you made friends? Was it kind of a community that, you know, that you became a part of as a result of not just residing but working so closely?
The people who live there, I never really got to be friends with, just one family of the people that I worked with,
mm-hmm.
but there was a real community of people who lived there,
mm-hmm.
you know, even though, and, excuse me, being close together, you know, is a relative thing. I mean, everybody had a minimum of 40 acres.
Yeah.
You know, so you would walk a lot. And, but there were, I would say, you know, what we considered to be a community was probably 30 people.
Okay.
Something like that, but all totally independent.
Okay.
you know, the community piece of it was more of a social thing than anything else. Mm-hmm. There was an odd, and it never dawned on me until way later, but there was an odd sort of lack of working together that I think just stemmed from everybody being there because they wanted to be independent.
That is so interesting. So they're so wedded to that mm-hmm. it just... That's yeah, space
you kind of lost the notion of asking for help.
Huh.
And I still suffer from that today. And that was kind of a permanent mindset for me.
That is so interesting because that's the value that gets praised so often. The whole communal thing, the camaraderie, the, you know, helpful hand.
There was all of that, but when it came to physically getting stuff done, everybody kind of did their own things.
Hmm. That's really quite interesting.
And there were some exceptions, but as a rule, everybody really focused on their own stuff.
So you said it really cemented, in many ways, how you deal with life today, right? So there's something about it that was really seminal.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, and I think mostly it was that notion of if you didn't do it yourself, it wasn't going to happen.
I think it should be on the poster, a very big poster that everybody looks at every day.
Yeah, but there's definitely a downside to it. You know, I think when you go through life that way, you miss out on some stuff.
True, but everything is a trade-off, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, this country is founded on what one of the core principles is independence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's such a huge value, and a lot of us got so away from that.
Right.
You know, the self-reliance piece of it, and it sounds like that's exactly what you practiced at a very young age.
Yeah, yeah, and we learned that because we had to, and it stuck. You know, and I think you have to. You know, there's a bunch of pieces that come after that, mm-hmm. you know, that you, mm-hmm. just because you're self-reliant doesn't mean you can be irresponsible.
Yes, yes, that's true.
You know, that there's still the responsibility to the bigger whole.
Well, being so close to the land, you know, again, so early on, had to have given you such a powerful perspective on that connection.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience. I mean, you know, people throw around the term life-changing experience. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a pretty cheap throwaway kind of term that people use. But that really was. I mean, that was kind of a big deal.
Wow. And you stuck with it. I mean...
Oh, yeah.
You were there, you said 5 summers, so you continued that lifestyle for another
Continued
year.
That lifestyle, and interestingly, the reason that I left... was that I wound up getting bored. that just doing the day-to-day, you know, how much wood can you cut? How much time can you spend in the garden?
Yeah.
You know, once all the big infrastructure stuff was done, then you were just doing life on the farm.
Yes.
And it wasn't quite enough, because it wasn't a real farm. I mean, because it was not farmland.
Mm-hmm.
It was up in the woods, and you could, you know, we had a nice little orchard, and we had a nice garden, but, you know, there just wasn't quite enough to do.
You had to cook, so you had to learn.
We had to cook, yeah.
Are you still a good cook?
Okay, I eat, I survive.
Got it.
So, we had developed a friendship with the first person that we met when we got to Ukiah. Was the new accounts lady at the Savings Bank of Mendocino County? Well, we drove across the country with probably, I think we each had like $10,000, so like $30,000 in cash,
right.
driving across the country. So we wanted to open a bank account. That felt like a grown-up thing to do, and there was this wonderful, wonderful woman. Who was the new accounts lady. She was just really sweet, really helpful and welcoming, and we got to be pretty close friends with her family, who had a great old homestead type family farm just at the beginning of Boonville Road when you turn to leave Ukiah and head towards Anderson Valley.
I think I know where that is.
Just right there on the left.
Wow. And, gorgeous spot.
Oh, way. Great spot.
My God.
Great, great spot. And they had pears and prunes and some vineyard. And over the years, from time to time, I would help Adrian, mostly during harvest, and drive a tractor and move bins around for him, and just little stuff, sometimes during the summer. Because with one of our logging jobs, I actually spent the summer with them because it was out by Lake Pillsbury. So it was a long drive, and the guy that I was working for lived in Ukiah. So I stayed with Jenny and Adrian. And so I would help him on the ranch in the evening, you know, move irrigation pipe and stuff like that. And when I got tired of living out in the woods, I went and talked to him about, you know, maybe this farming thing would be something I'd be interested in doing. I kind of like this. And I knew nothing. I mean, really nothing. I had not even the smallest clue about how to grow a grapevine. And he couldn't give me a job. He was barely making a living, you know, for his family. He had 60 acres, and he did most of the work himself, but he had two kids that were still in high school, and so it just wasn't going to happen. But right about at that time, Andy Beckstoffer had bought the old Mendocino State Hospital property in Ukiah, actually in Talmadge, just south and east of Ukiah. And it was an amazing, amazing piece of property. It had, you know, the state hospital campus, which is really reminiscent of like the Napa State Hospital, like at Imola, just a bunch of big old buildings. But they also had like 500 acres of farmland.
Amazing.
And it was such a great thing, you know. And I don't know who was the governor at the time, but in their wisdom, they decided, you know, that they were going to scale way back on all of these state mental hospital programs. And this place was virtually self-sufficient. Plus, they grew a lot of food and meat and dairy products for the whole state hospital system.
How about that?
So they decided to close that down because it didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You know, and you talk about great therapy. You know, I mean, the people who lived there did all the work.
Wow.
And it was a really, really cool thing. But when they shut it down, Andy decided that he wanted to expand outside of Napa.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that early on.
Yeah, it was in the late 70s.
Wow, because I know he's really very heavily engaged with Lake County, but I didn't realize how deep the roots go. He actually had a vision at the time. He must have.
At one point, he still may have over 1,000 acres of vineyard in Mendocino County.
Wow.
And it went way back to then. And they were in this development process, and there was, Adrian knew and was pretty close friends with Andy's general manager up there. And he went and talked to him, and he said, you know, there's this young guy, he wants to move into town, he's about to get married, wants to settle down a little bit, and he thinks he might want to work in a vineyard. And, you know, very impressive recommendation. and he said, the only thing I can tell you about him is that he's not afraid to work.
Work ethic.
Yeah.
Important.
And Morgan said, good, we want people like that. And gave us a house to live in on the property, and just there was this wonderful guy who worked for Andy. Could be like the, I mean, he didn't give me opportunities, but was probably the most influential person, you know, in terms of me wanting to be a grape grower. Mm-hmm. His name was Ernie Cizzoni, and Ernie was like in his 60s at that point, and he had literally grown up under a grapevine. That's all Ernie ever did.
I was Italian.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep, he was one of the old Italian Mendocino County families.
Very cool.
And the first day, first morning, go to work, and Morgan didn't quite know what to do with me. He hadn't thought about it very much. and he said, go with Ernie. And that was kind of all I did, was go with Ernie and just be like a puppy dog following him around. And asking lots of questions, and he was just an amazing teacher, you know. And he just had this great sense, just an innate sense, about grapevines and how they grew and what the right thing to do was and what the wrong thing to do was. And I'm gonna say maybe 3 or 4 months after being there, and then when there wasn't stuff to do with Ernie, I worked with the crew. You know, I would just go up and down the row with everybody else, you know, learning as I went, you know, and learn to keep up. And it probably took like 3 or 4 months, and a light bulb went on. I was like, I really like this. I think this is what I'm going to do.
So there's an emotional connection that was formed.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so, but also kind of an intellectual connection, that it just made sense to me, mm-hmm. that what you're doing is totally dictated by nature. Mm. You know, it's not like you're sitting in an office deciding what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You're much more reacting to what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I still think that today the most important thing that a good farmer does is how they react and how they don't react. You know, there's a lot of people in this industry feel like they have to do something.
Exactly. And I think it's part of human nature, it's exerting control. Mm-hmm. What you're describing is the opposite.
Well, it depends on how you think of it. You know, not doing something can be a very
right.
conscious
Absolutely.
Decision.
It's also a decision, yeah.
And just having that connection to nature and driving what you're doing. Yeah, I mean, if the frost alarm goes off at 2 a.m, it's kind of a pain in the ass, but it's what you do.
Yeah. Is it a dialogue then of sorts when you really are very attuned to what happens, and then your reaction is tailored to what you perceive as happening?
Well, you know, the way it happens for me, I think it harkens back to that, the conversation about self-reliance. I mean, there's the dialogue, but it happens in my head.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't happen out loud.
Right, of course. No, it's all between the ears, but it's such an interesting piece for me, because again, I think human nature is that, you know, maybe it's insecurity. I don't know where exactly it comes from, but most of us want to exert control because that's a knee-jerk reaction. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, something needs to be fixed.
Right.
And it's taking that step back mm-hmm. and actually listening, thinking,
yeah,
and relating mm-hmm. to what you're touching with your hands, in your case, very hands-on. Meaning that, you know, it's not remote. You're not writing in a piece of paper and then something happens in some other realm. You actually are, in fact, very directly involved with your craft.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you need to pay a lot of attention to what the vines are telling you.
Yeah.
You know, because they're the ones that are, you know, telling you what they need.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palette Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.